another of his splintered smiles. "Very astute, Mr. Kovach, but you need have nothing to fear on that count. The Y Clinic, what little you left of it, is reluctant to either release internal video footage or press charges against anyone. They have more to fear in any investigation than you do. Of course, whether they choose to seek more private reprisals is, shall we say, a more protracted question."
"And Jerry's?"
A shrug. "The same. With the proprietor dead, a managing interest has stepped in."
"Very tidy."
"I'm glad you appreciate it."
Bancroft got to his feet.
"As I said, it has been a busy morning, and negotiations are by no means at an end. I would be grateful if you could limit your depredations somewhat in the future. It has been costly."
Getting to my feet, just for a moment, I had the traceries of fire at Inanin across the back of my vision. The screaming deaths heard at a level that was bone deep, and suddenly Bancroft's elegant understatement rang sickly and grotesque, like the antiseptic words of General McIntyre's damage reports, for securing the Inanin beachhead, a price well worth paying. Like Bancroft, McIntyre had been a man of power, and like all men of power, when he talked of prices worth paying, you could be sure of one thing. Someone else was paying. Chapter 17. The Fell Street Station was an unassuming block done out in a style I assumed must be Martian Baroque. Whether it had been planned that way as a police station or taken over after the fact was difficult to decide. The place was potentially a fortress. The mock-eroded ruby-stone facings and hooded buttresses provided a series of natural niches in which were set high, stained-glass windows edged by the unobtrusive nubs of shield generators. Below the windows, the abrasive red surface of the stonework was sculpted into jagged obstructions that caught the morning light and turned it bloody. I couldn't tell whether the steps up to the arched entrance were deliberately uneven or just well-worn. Inside, stained light from a window and a peculiar calm fell on me simultaneously. Subsonics, I guessed, casting a glance around at the human flotsam waiting submissively on the benches. If these were arrested suspects, they had been rendered remarkably unconcerned by something, and I doubted it would be the Zen populist murals that someone had commissioned for the hall. I crossed the patch of colored light cast by the window, picked my way through small knots of people conversing in lowered tones, more appropriate to a library than a holding center, and found myself at a reception counter. A uniformed cop, presumably the desk sergeant, blinked kindly back at me. The subsonics were obviously getting to him as well. "Lieutenant Ortega," I told him. "Organic damage."
"Who shall I say it is?"
"Tell her it's Elias Riker." Out of the corner of my eye, I saw another uniform turn at the sound of the name. But nothing was said. The desk sergeant spoke into his phone, listened, then turned back to me.
"She's sending someone down. Are you armed?"
I nodded and reached under my jacket for the Nemex.
"Please surrender the weapon carefully," he added with a gentle smile. "Our security software is a little touchy, and it's apt to stun you if you look like you're pulling something."
I slowed my movements to frame advance, dumped the Nemex on the desk, and set about unstrapping the Tebbit knife from my arm. When I was finished, the sergeant beamed beatifically at me.
"Thank you. It'll all be returned to you when you leave the building."
The words were barely out of his mouth when two of the Mohicans appeared through a door at the back of the hall and directed themselves rapidly toward me. Their faces were painted with identical glowers that the subsonics apparently made little impact on in the short time it took them to reach me. They went for an arm apiece.
"I wouldn't," I told them. "Hey, he's not under arrest, you know," the desk sergeant said pacifically.
One of the Mohicans jerked a glance at him and snorted in exasperation. The other one just stared at me the whole time, as if he hadn't eaten red meat recently. I met the stare with a gentle smile. Following the meeting with Bancroft, I had gone back to the Hendricks and slept for almost 20 hours. I was rested, neurochemically alert, and feeling a cordial dislike of authority of which Quell herself would have been proud. It must have shown. The Mohicans abandoned their attempts to paw me, and the three of us rode up 4 floors in silence, broken only by the creak of the ancient elevator. Ortega's office had one of the stained-glass windows, or more precisely, the bottom half of one, before it was bisected horizontally by the ceiling. Presumably, the remainder rose missile-like from the floor of the office above. I began to see some evidence for the original building having been converted to its present use. The other walls of the office were environment-formatted, with a tropical sunset over water and islands. The combination of stained glass and sunset meant that the office was filled with a soft orange light in which you could see the drifting of dust motes. The lieutenant was seated behind a heavy wooden desk, as if caged there, chin propped on one cupped hand, one shin and knee pressed hard against the edge of the desk. She was brooding over the scroll-down of an antique laptop when we came through the door. Aside from the machine, the only items on the desktop were a battered-looking heavy-caliber Smith & Wesson and a plastic cup of coffee, heating tab still unpulled. She dismissed the Mohicans with a nod.
"Sit down, Kovac."
I glanced around, saw a framed chair under the window, and hooked it up to the desk. The late afternoon light in the office was disorienting. "You work the night shift?" Her eyes flared.
"What kind of crack is that?"
"Hey, nothing." I held up my hands and gestured at the low light. "I just thought you might have cycled the walls for it. You know, it's 10 o'clock in the morning outside."
"Oh, that,"
Ortega grunted, and her eyes swiveled back down to the screen display. It was hard to tell in the tropical sunset, but I thought they might be gray-green, like the sea around the maelstrom.
"It's out of sync. The department got it cheap from someplace in El Paso Juarez. Jams up completely sometimes."
"That's tough."
"Yeah, sometimes I'll just turn it off, but the neons are..."
She looked up abruptly.
"What the fuck am I... Kovac, do you know how close you are to a storage rack right now?"
I made a span of my right index finger and thumb and looked at her through it. "About the width of a testimony from the Y Clinic was what I heard."
"We can put you there, Kovac. 7:43 yesterday morning, walking out the front door larger than life."
I shrugged.
"And don't think your meth connections are going to keep you organic forever. There's a Y Clinic limo driver telling interesting stories about hijack and real death. Maybe he'll have something to say about you."
"Impound his vehicle, did you?" I asked casually. "Or did Y reclaim it before you could run tests?" Ortega's mouth compressed into a hard line. I nodded. "Thought so. And the driver will say precisely zero until Y springs him, I imagine."
"Listen, Kovac. I keep pushing. Something's got to give. It's a matter of time, motherfucker. Strictly that."
"Admirable tenacity," I said. "Shame you didn't have some of that for the Bancroft case."
"There is no fucking Bancroft case!"
Ortega was on her feet, palms hard down on the desktop, eyes slitted in rage and disgust. I waited, nerves sprung in case Bay City police stations were as prone to accidental suspect injury as some others I had known. Finally, the lieutenant drew a deep breath and lowered herself joint by joint back into her seat. The anger had smoothed off her face, but the disgust was still there, caught in the fine lines at the corners of her eyes and the set of her wide mouth. She looked at her nails.
"Do you know what we found at the Y Clinic yesterday?"
"Black market spare parts? Virtual torture programs? Or didn't they let you stay that long?"
"We found 17 bodies with their cortical stacks burnt out. Unarmed. 17 dead people. Really dead."
She looked up at me again, the disgust still there. "You'll have to pardon my lack of reaction," I said coldly. "I saw a lot worse when I was in uniform. In fact, I did a lot worse when I was fighting the Protectorate's battles for them."
"That was war."
"Oh, please." She said nothing. I leaned forward across the desk. "And don't tell me those 17 bodies are what you're on fire about, either." I gestured at my own face. "This is your problem. You don't like the idea of someone carving this up." She sat silent for a moment, thinking, then reached into a drawer of the desk and took out a pack of cigarettes. She offered them to me automatically, and I shook my head with clenched determination. "I quit."
"Did you?"
There was genuine surprise in her voice as she fed herself a cigarette and lit it.
"Good for you. I'm impressed."
"Yeah. Riker should be pleased, too, when he gets off stack." She paused behind the veil of smoke, then dropped the pack back into the drawer and palm-heeled it shut.
"What do you want?"
she asked flatly. The holding racks were 5 floors down in a double-story basement, where it was easier to regulate temperatures. Compared to Psychosec, it was a toilet.
"I don't see that this is going to change anything,"
Ortega said, as we followed a yawning technician along the steel gantry to slot 3089B.
"What's Cadman going to tell you that he hasn't told us?"
"Look." I stopped and turned to face her, hands spread and held low. On the narrow gantry we were uncomfortably close. Something chemical happened, and the geometries of Ortega's stance seemed suddenly fluid, dangerously tactile. I felt my mouth dry up.
"I..."
she said.
3089B,
the technician called, hefting the big 30-centimeter disc out of its slot.
"This the one you wanted, Lieutenant?"
Ortega pushed hurriedly past me.
"That's it, Mickey. Can you set us up with a virtual?"
"Sure."
Mickey jerked a thumb at one of the spiral staircases, collared in at intervals along the gantry.
"You want to go down to 5, slap on the trodes. Take about 5 minutes."
"The point is," I said, as the three of us clattered down the steel steps, "you're the Shia. Cadman knows you. He's been dealing with you all his professional life. It's part of what he does. I'm an unknown. If he's never been extra system, the chances are he's never met an envoy before. And they tell nasty stories about the Corps most places I've been." Ortega gave me a skeptical look over her shoulder.
"You're going to frighten him into a statement? Dmitri Cadman? I don't think so."
"He'll be off balance, and when people are off balance, they give things away. Don't forget, this guy's working for someone who wants me dead. Someone who is scared of me, at least superficially. Some of that may rub off on Cadman."
"And this is supposed to convince me that someone murdered Bancroft after all?"
"Ortega, it doesn't matter whether you believe it or not. We've been through this already. You want Riker's sleeve back in the tank ASAP, out of harm's way. The sooner we get to whatever bottom there is to Bancroft's death, the sooner that happens. And I'm a lot less likely to incur substantial organic damage if I'm not stumbling around in the dark. If I have your help, in fact. You don't want the sleeve to get written off in another firefight, do you?"
"Another firefight?"
It had taken nearly half an hour of heated discussion to hammer the sense of the new relationship into Ortega, and the policewoman in her still hadn't gone to sleep on me. "Yeah, after the Hendrix." I improvised rapidly, cursing the face-to-face chemical interlock that had put me off balance. "I picked up some bad bruising there. Could have been a lot worse." She shot me another, longer glance over her shoulder. The virtual interrogation system was housed in a series of bubble-fab cabins at one side of the basement floor. Mickey settled both of us onto weary-looking auto-mold couches that were slow to respond to our forms, applied the electrodes and hypnophones, then kicked in the power with a concert pianist's sweep of one arm across 2 of the utilitarian consoles. He studied the screens as they blinked on.
"Traffic,"
he said, and hawked congestion into the back of his throat with disgust.
"Commissioner's hooked in with some kind of conference environment, and it's soaking up half the system. Gotta wait till someone else gets off."
He glanced back at Ortega.
"Hey, that the Mary Lou Hinchley thing?"
"Yeah."
Ortega looked across to include me in the conversation, maybe as evidence of our new cooperation.
"Last year the Coastals fished some kid out of the ocean. Mary Lou Hinchley. Not much left of the body, but they got the stack. Set it to spin, and guess what?"
"Catholic?"
"In one.
That total absorb stuff works, huh? Yeah, the first entry scan comes up with barred by reasons of conscience decals. Usually the end of the line in a case like that, but L...
She stopped, restarted.
The detective in charge wouldn't let it go. Hinchley was from his neighborhood. He knew her when she was growing up. Not well, but...
She shrugged.
He wouldn't let it go.
Very tenacious. Elias Riker? She nodded.
He pushed the path labs for a month. In the end, they found some evidence the body had been thrown out of an air car. Organic damage did some background digging and came up with a conversion less than 10 months old, and a hard-line Catholic boyfriend with skills in infotech who might have faked the vow. The girl's family are borderliners, nominally Christian but mostly not Catholic. Quite rich as well, with a vault full of stacked ancestors that they spin out for family births and marriages. The department's been in virtual consultation with a lot of them on and off all this year.
Roll on Resolution 653, huh?
Yeah.
We both went back to looking at the ceiling above the couches. The cabin was bottom-of-the-line bubble fab, blown from a single globe of polyfiber like chicle in a child's mouth. Doors and windows lasered out and reattached with epoxy hinges afterwards. The curved gray ceiling held absolutely nothing of interest.
"Tell me something, Ortega,"
I said after a while.
"That tale you had on me Tuesday afternoon when I went shopping, how come he was so much worse than the others? A blind man could have spotted him."
There was a pause before she spoke. Then, grudgingly,
"All we had. It was a snap thing. We had to get you covered quick after you dumped the clothes."
"The clothes?" I closed my eyes.
"Oh, no. You tagged the suit? That simple?"
"Yep."
I threw my mind back to my first meeting with Ortega. The justice facility, the ride out to Suntouch House. The total recall ripped through the footage on Fast Forward. I saw us standing on the sunlit lawn with Miriam Bancroft, Ortega departing.
"Got it," I snapped my fingers. "You hammered me on the shoulder when you left."
"I can't believe I'm this stupid."
"Enzyme bond bleeper," Ortega said matter-of-factly. "Not much bigger than a fly's eye. And we figured, with autumn well set in, you wouldn't be going many places without your jacket. Course, when you offloaded it into that trash bin, we thought you'd tipped us."
"No, nothing so bright."
"That's it,"
Mickey announced suddenly.
"Ladies and gentlemen, hold on to your spinal spiral. We are in the pipe."
It was a rougher ride than I'd expected from a government department installation, but no worse than many jury-rigged virtuals I'd done on the world. First the hypnos, pulsing their sonar codes until the dull gray ceiling grew abruptly fascinating with fishtail swirls of light and meaning drained out of the universe like dirty water from a sink. And then I was elsewhere. It spread out around me, racing away from my viewpoint in all directions, like nothing so much as a huge magnification of one of the spiral steps we'd used to get down from the gantry. Steel gray, stippled every few meters with a nipple-like swelling, receding to infinity. The sky above was a paler shade of the same gray, with shiftings that seemed vaguely to suggest bars and antique locks. Nice psychology, assuming any of the felons interrogated had anything but race memory of what an actual lock looked like. In front of me, softly shaped gray furniture was evolving from the floor like a sculpture from a pool of mercury. A plain metal table first, then two chairs this side, one opposite. Their edges and surfaces ran liquidly smooth for the final seconds of their emergence, then snapped solid and geometric as they took on an existence separate from the floor. Ortega appeared beside me, at first a pale pencil sketch of a woman, all flickering lines and diffident shading. As I watched, pastel colors raced through her, and her movements grew more defined. She was turning to speak to me, one hand reaching into the pocket of her jacket. I waited, and the final gloss of color popped out onto her surfaces. She produced her cigarettes.
"Smoke?"
"No, thanks. I..." Realizing the futility of worrying about virtual health, I accepted the pack and shook one out. Ortega lit us both with her lighter,
and the first bite of smoke in my lungs was ecstasy. I looked up at the geometric sky. "Is this standard?"
"Pretty much."
Ortega squinted into the distance.
"Resolution looks a bit higher than usual. Think Mickey's showing off."
Cadman scribbled into existence on the other side of the table. Before the virtual program had even colored him in properly, he became aware of us and folded his arms across his chest. If my appearance in the cell was putting him off balance, as hoped, it didn't show.
"Again, Lieutenant," he said when the program had rendered him complete. "There is a UN ruling on maximum virtual time for one arrest, you know."
"That's right, and we're still a long way off it," Ortega said. "Why don't you sit down, Cadman?"
"No, thank you."
"I said sit, motherfucker!"
There was an abrupt undercurrent of steel in the cop's voice, and magically Cadman blinked off and reappeared seated at the table.
His face betrayed a momentary flash of rage at the displacement, but then it was gone, and he unfolded his arms in an ironic gesture.
"You're right. It's so much more comfortable like this. Won't you both join me?"
We took our seats in the more conventional way, and I stared at Cadman as we did it. It was the first time I'd seen anything quite like it. He was the patchwork man. Most virtual systems recreate you from self-images held in the memory, with a common-sense subroutine to prevent your delusions from impinging too much. I generally come out a little taller and thinner in the face than I usually am. In this case, the system seemed to have scrambled a myriad different perceptions from Cadman's presumably long list of sleeves. I'd seen it done before, as a technique, but most of us grow rapidly attached to whatever sleeves we're living in, and that form blanks out previous incarnations. We are, after all, evolved to relate to the physical world. The man in front of me was different. His frame was that of a Caucasian Nordic, topping mine by nearly 30 centimeters. But the face was at odds. It began African, broad and deep ebony, but the color ended like a mask under the eyes, and the lower half was divided along the line of the nose, pale copper on the left, corpse white on the right. The nose was both fleshy and aquiline, and mediated well between the top and bottom halves of the face, but the mouth was a mismatch of left and right sides that left the lips peculiarly twisted. Long, straight black hair was combed mane-like back from the forehead, shot through on one side with pure white. The hands, immobile on the metal table, were equipped with claws similar to the ones I'd seen on the giant freak fighter in Licktown, but the fingers were long and sensitive. He had breasts, impossibly full on a torso so over-muscled. The eyes, set in jet skin, were a startling pale green. Cadman had freed himself from conventional perceptions of the physical.
In an earlier age, he would have been a shaman. Here, the centuries of technology had made him more.
An electronic demon, a malignant spirit that dwelled in altered carbon and emerged only to possess flesh and wreak havoc. He would have made a fine envoy. "I take it I don't have to introduce myself," I said quietly. Cadman grinned, revealing small teeth and a delicate pointed tongue.
"If you're a friend of the lieutenant, you don't have to do anything you don't want to here. Only the slobs get their virtuality edited."
"Do you know this man, Cadman?" Ortega asked.
"Hoping for a confession, Lieutenant?"
Cadman threw back his head and laughed musically.
"Oh, the crudity! This man? This woman, maybe? Oh, yes, even a dog could be trained to say as much as he has said, given the right tranquilizers, of course. They do tend to go pitifully insane when you decant them, if not. But yes, even a dog. We sit here, three silhouettes carved from electronic sleet in a different storm, and you talk like a cheap period drama. Limited vision, Lieutenant, limited vision. Where is the voice that said altered carbon would free us from the cells of our flesh? The vision that said we would be angels?"
"You tell me, Cadman,"
You're the one with the exalted professional standing.
Ortega's tone was detached. She system-magicked a long scroll of printout into one hand and glanced idly down it.
Pimp, triad enforcer, virtual interrogator in the corporate wars. It's all quality work. Me, I'm just some dumb cop, can't see the light.
I'm not going to quarrel with you there, Lieutenant.
Says here you were a wiper for Meritcon a while back, scaring archaeologue miners off their claims in Syrtis Major, slaughtering their families by way of incentive. Nice job.
Ortega tossed the printout back into oblivion.
We've got you cold, Cadman. Digital footage from the hotel surveillance system, verifiable simultaneous leaving, both stacks on ice. That's an erasure mandatory. And even if your lawyers dance it down to compliance and machine error, the sun's going to be a red dwarf by the time they let you off stack.
Cadman smiled. Then what are you here for? Who sent you? I asked him softly.
The dog speaks. Is it a wolf I hear? Howling his lonely communion with the unpiloted stars, or merely the self-importance and servitude in the bark of a dog. How many millennia did it take, twisting and torturing the pride from the one, to make a tool, the other?
I inhaled smoke and nodded. Like most Harlanites, I knew Quell's poems and other prevarications more or less by heart. It was taught in schools in lieu of the later and weightier political works, most of which were still deemed too radical to be put in the hands of children. This wasn't a great translation, but it captured the essence. More impressive was the fact that anyone not actually from Harlan's world could quote such an obscure volume. I finished it for him. And how do we measure the distance from spirit to spirit? And who do we find to blame?
Have you come seeking blame, Mr. Kovach?
Among other things.
How disappointing.
You expected something else?
No,
Cadman said with another smile.
Expectation is our first mistake. I meant, how disappointing for you.
Maybe.
He shook his great piebald head. Certainly. You will take no names from me. If you seek blame, I will have to bear it for you.
That's very generous, but you'll remember what Quell said about lackeys.
Kill them along the way, but count your bullets, for there are more worthy targets.
Cadman chuckled deep inside himself.
Are you threatening me in monitored police storage?
No, I'm just putting things into perspective. I knocked ash off my cigarette and watched it sparkle out of existence before it reached the floor. Someone's pulling your strings. That's who I'm going to wipe. You're nothing. You I wouldn't waste spit on.
Cadman tipped his head back as a stronger tremor ran through the shifting lines on the sky, like cubist lightning.
It reflected in the dull sheen on the metal table and seemed to touch his hands for a moment. When he looked down at me again, it was with a curious light in his eyes.
I was not asked to kill you, he said tonelessly, unless your abduction proved inconvenient. But now I will.
Ortega was on him as the last syllable left his mouth. The table blinked out of existence, and she kicked him backwards off the chair with one booted foot. As he rolled back to his feet, the same boot caught him in the mouth and floored him again. I ran my tongue around the almost healed gashes inside my own mouth and felt a distinct lack of sympathy. Ortega dragged Cadman up by the hair, the cigarette in her hand replaced by a vicious-looking blackjack, courtesy of the same system magic that had eliminated the table.
I hear you right, she hissed. You making threats, fuckhead?
Cadman bared his teeth in a blood-stained grin.
Police brutal.
That's right, motherfucker!
Ortega hit him across the cheek with a blackjack. The skin split.
Police brutality in a monitored police virtuality. Sandy Kim and World Web One would have a field day, wouldn't they? But you know what?
I reckon your lawyers aren't going to want to run this particular tape.
Leave him alone, Ortega. She seemed to remember herself then and stepped back. Her face twitched and she drew a deep breath. The table blinked back, and Cadman was suddenly sitting upright again, mouth undamaged.
You too, he said quietly.
Yeah, sure.
There was contempt in Ortega's voice, at least half of it directed at herself, I guessed. She made a second effort to bring her breathing back under control, rearranged her clothing unnecessarily.
Like I said, going to be a cold day in hell by the time you get the chance. Maybe I'll wait for you.
Whoever sent you worth this much, Cadman? I wondered softly. You going down silent out of contractual loyalty, or are you just scared shitless? For answer, the composite man folded his arms across his chest and stared through me.
You through, Kovac?
Ortega asked. I tried to meet Cadman's distant gaze. Cadman, the man I work for has a lot of influence. This could be your last chance to cut a deal. Nothing. He didn't even blink. I shrugged. I'm through.
Good, Ortega said grimly, because sitting downwind of this piece of shit is beginning to eat away at my usually tolerant nature.
She waggled her fingers in front of his eyes.
Be seeing you, fuckhead.
At that, Cadman's eyes turned up to meet hers, and a small, peculiarly unpleasant smile twisted his lips. We left. Back on the fourth floor, the walls of Ortega's office had reverted to a dazzling high noon over beaches of white sand. I screwed up my eyes against the glare while Ortega trawled through a desk drawer and came up with her own and a spare pair of sunglasses.
So what did you learn from that?
I fitted the lenses uncomfortably over the bridge of my nose. They were too small. Not much, except that little gem about not having orders to wipe me. Someone wanted to talk to me. I'd pretty much guessed that anyway, else he could have just blown my stack out all over the lobby of the Hendrix. Still, means someone wanted to cut a deal of their own outside of Bancroft.
Or someone wanted to interrogate the guts out of you.
I shook my head. About what? I'd only just arrived. Doesn't make any sense.
The car? Unfinished business?
Ortega made little flicking motions with her hand, as if she were dealing me the suggestions.
Maybe a grudge match?
No, we went through this one when we were yelling at each other the other night. There are people who'd like to see me wiped, but none of them live on Earth. And none of them swing the kind of influence to go interstellar. And there's nothing I know about the Corps that isn't in a low-wall database somewhere. And anyway, it's just too much of a fucking coincidence. Now, this is about Bancroft. Someone wanted in on the program.
Whoever had him killed?
I tipped my head down to look at her directly over the sun lenses. You believe me, then?
Not entirely.
Oh, come on. But Ortega wasn't listening.
What I want to know, she brooded, is why he rewrote his codes at the end. You know, we've sweated him nearly a dozen times since we downloaded him Sunday night. That's the first time he's come close to even admitting he was there.
Even to his lawyers?
We don't know what he says to them. They're big-time sharks out of Ulaanbaatar in New York. That kind of money carries a scrambler into all privy virtual interviews. We get nothing on tape but static.
I raised a mental eyebrow. On Harlan's world, all virtual custody was monitored as a matter of course. Scramblers were not permitted, no matter how much money you were worth. Speaking of lawyers, are Cadmans here in Bay City?
Physically, you mean? Yeah, they've got a deal with the Marin County practice. One of their partners is renting a sleeve here for the duration.
Ortega's lip curled.
Physical meetings are considered a touch of class these days. Only the cheap firms do business down the wires.
What's the suit's name? There was a brief pause while she hung on to the name.
Cadman's a spinning item right now. I'm not sure we go this far.
Ortega, we go all the way. That was the deal. Otherwise, I'm back to risking Elias's fine features with some more maximal push investigation. She was silent for a while.
Rutherford, she said finally, You want to talk to Rutherford?
Right now I want to talk to anyone. Maybe I didn't make things clear earlier. I'm working cold here. Bancroft waited a month and a half before he brought me in. Cadman's all I've got.
Keith Rutherford's a handful of engine grease. You won't get any more out of him than you did Cadman downstairs. And anyway, how the fuck am I supposed to introduce you, Kovach?
Hi, Keith. This is the ex-envoy, Luce Cannon, your client tried to wipe on Sunday. He'd like to ask you a few questions. He'll close up faster than an unpaid hooker's hole.
She had a point. I thought about it for a moment, staring out to sea. All right, I said slowly. All I need is a couple of minutes' conversation. How about you tell him I'm Elias Riker, your partner from Organic Damage? I practically am, after all. Ortega took off her lenses and stared at me.
Are you trying to be funny?
No, I'm trying to be practical. Rutherford's sleeving in from Ulan Bator, right?
New York, she said tightly.
New York, right. So he probably doesn't know anything about you or Riker.
Probably not.
So what's the problem?
The problem is, Kovach, that I don't like it.
There was more silence. I dropped my gaze into my lap and let out a sigh that was only partially manufactured. Then I took off my own sunglasses and looked up at her. It was all there on plain display. The naked fear of sleeving and all that it entailed. Paranoid essentialism with its back to the wall.
Ortega, I said gently, I'm not him. I'm not trying to be hit.
You couldn't even come close,
she snapped. All we're talking about is a couple of hours make-believe.
Is that all?
She said it in a voice like iron, and she put her sunglasses back on with such brusque efficiency that I didn't need to see the tears welling up in the eyes behind the mirror lenses.
All right,
she said finally, clearing her throat.
I'll get you in. I don't see the point, but I'll do it. Then what?
That's a little difficult to say. I'll have to improvise.
Like you did at the Y Clinic?
I shrugged noncommittally. Envoy techniques are largely reactive. I can't react to something until it happens.
I don't want another bloodbath, Kovach. It looks bad on the city's stats.
If there's violence, it won't be me that starts it.
That's not much of a guarantee. Haven't you got any idea what you're going to do?
I'm going to talk.
Just talk?
She looked at me disbelievingly.
That's all?
I fitted my ill-fitting sunglasses back over my face. Sometimes that's all it takes, I said.
Chapter 18. I met my first lawyer when I was 15. He was a harried-looking juvenile affray expert who defended me, not unhandily, in a minor organic damage suit involving a new pest police officer. He bargained them down with a kind of myopic patience to conditional release and 11 minutes of virtual psychiatric counseling. In the hall outside the juvenile court, he looked into my probably infuriatingly smug face and nodded as if his worst fears about the meaning of his life were being confirmed. Then he turned on his heel and walked away. I forget his name. My entry into the new pest gang scene shortly afterwards precluded any more such legal encounters. The gangs were web-smart, wired up, and already writing their own intrusion programs, or buying them from kids half their age in return for low-grade virtual porn ripped off the networks. They didn't get caught easily, and in return for this favor, the new pest heat tended to leave them alone. Inter-gang violence was largely ritualized and excluded other players most of the time. On the odd occasion that it spilled over and affected civilians, there would be a rapid and brutal series of punitive raids that left a couple of lead gang heroes in the store, and the rest of us with extensive bruising. Fortunately, I never worked my way up the chain of command far enough to get put away, so the next time I saw the inside of a courtroom was the internet inquiry. The lawyers I saw there had about as much in common with a man who had defended me at 15 as automated machine rifle fire has with farting. They were cold, professionally polished, and well on their way up a career ladder that would ensure that despite the uniforms they wore, they would never have to come within 1,000 kilometers of a genuine firefight. The only problem they had as they cruised sharkishly back and forth across the cool marble floor of the court was in drawing the fine differences between war, mass murder of people wearing a uniform not your own, justifiable loss, mass murder of your own troops, but with substantial gains, and criminal negligence, mass murder of your own troops without appreciable benefit. I sat in that courtroom for 3 weeks, listening to them dress it like a variety of salads, and with each passing hour the distinctions, which at one point I'd been pretty clear on, grew increasingly vague. I suppose that proves how good they were. After that, straightforward criminality came as something of a relief. Something bothering you? Ortega glanced sideways at me as she brought the unmarked cruiser down on a shelving pebble beach below the split-level glass-fronted offices of Pendergrast Sanchez, attorneys at law. Just thinking.
Try cold showers and alcohol. Works for me.
I nodded and held up the minuscule bead of metal I had been rolling between my finger and thumb. Is this legal? Ortega reached up and killed the primaries.
More or less. No one's going to complain.
Good. Now, I'm going to need verbal cover to start with. You do the talking. I'll just shut up and listen. Take it from there.
Fine. Riker was like that anyway. Never used two words if one would do it. Most of the time with the scumbags, he'd just look at them.
Sort of a Mickey Nozawa type, huh?
Who?
Never mind. The rattle of upthrown pebbles on the hull died away as Ortega cut the engines to idle. I stretched in my seat and threw open my side of the hatch. Climbing out, I saw an over-burly figure coming down the meandering set of wooden steps from the split level. Looked like grafting. A blunt-looking gun was slung over his shoulder, and he wore gloves. Probably not a lawyer.
Go easy, Ortega said, suddenly at my shoulder. We have jurisdiction here. He isn't going to start anything.
She flashed her badge as the muscle jumped the last step to the beach and landed on flexed legs. You could see the disappointment on his face as he saw it.
Bay City Police, we're here to see Rutherford.
You can't park that here.
I already have,
Ortega told him evenly.
Are we going to keep Mr. Rutherford waiting?
There was a prickly silence, but she'd gauged him correctly. Contenting himself with a grunt, the muscle gestured us up the staircase and followed at prudent shepherding distance. It took a while to get to the top, and I was pleased to see when we arrived that Ortega was considerably more out of breath than I was. We went across a modest sun deck made from the same wood as the stairs, and through two sets of automatic plate glass doors into a reception area, styled to look like someone's lounge. There were rugs on the floor, knitted in the same patterns as my jacket, and amethyst prints on the walls. 5 single armchairs provided parking.
Can I help you?
This was a lawyer, no question about it. A smoothly groomed blonde woman in a loose skirt and jacket tailored to fit the room, hands resting comfortably in her pockets.
Bay City Police, where's Rutherford?
The woman flickered a glance sideways at our escort, and, having received the nod, did not bother to demand identification.
I'm afraid Keith is occupied at the moment. He's in virtual with New York.
Well, get him out of virtual, then, Ortega said with dangerous mildness, and tell him the officer who arrested his client is here to see him. I'm sure he'll be interested.
That may take some time, officer.
No, it won't.
The two women locked gazes for a moment, and then the lawyer looked away. She nodded to the muscle, who went back outside, still looking disappointed.
"I'll see what I can do," she said glacially. "Please wait here."
We waited, Ortega at the floor-to-ceiling window staring down at the beach with her back to the room, and myself prowling the artwork. Some of it was quite good. With the separately ingrained habits of working in monitored environments, neither of us said anything for the 10 minutes it took to produce Rutherford from the inner sanctum. "Lieutenant Ortega!" The modulated voice reminded me of Miller's at the clinic, and when I looked up from a print over the fireplace, I saw much the same kind of sleeve. Maybe a little older, with slightly craggier patriarchal features designed to inspire instant respect in jurors and judges alike, but the same athletic frame and off-the-rack good looks.
To what do I owe this unexpected visit? Not more harassment, I hope.
Ortega ignored the allegation.
Detective Sergeant Elias Riker,
she said, nodding at me. Your client just admitted to one count of abduction and made a first-degree organic damage threat under monitor. Care to see the footage?
Not particularly. Care to tell me why you're here?
Rutherford was good. He'd barely reacted. Barely. But enough to catch it out of the corner of my eye. My mind went into overdrive. Ortega leaned on the back of an armchair.
For a man defending a mandatory erasure case, you're showing a real lack of imagination.
Rutherford sighed theatrically.
You have called me away from an important link. I assume you do have something to say.
Do you know what third-party retroassociative complicity is? I asked the question without turning from the print, and when I did look up, I had Rutherford's complete attention.
I do not, he said stiffly.
That's a pity, because you and the other partners of Bozala Bennett are right in the firing line if Cadman rolls over. But of course, if that happens... I spread my hands and shrugged. It'll be open season. In fact, it may already be.
All right, that's enough.
Rutherford's hand rose decisively to a remote summons emitter pinned to his lapel. Our escort was on his way.
I don't have time to play games with you. There is no statute by that name, and this is getting perilously close to harassment.
I raised my voice. Just wanted to know which side you want to be on when the program crashes, Rutherford. There is a statute, UN indictable offense, last handed down 4th of May, 2207. Look it up. I had to go back a long way to dig this one up, but it'll take all of you down in the end. Cadman knows it. That's why he's cracking.
Rutherford smiled. I don't think so, Detective.
I repeated my shrug. Shame. Like I said, look it up. Then decide which side you want to play for. We're going to need inside corroboration, and we're prepared to pay for it. If it isn't you, Ulan Bator's stuffed with lawyers who'll give blowjobs for the chance.
The smile wavered fractionally.
That's right. Think about it.
I nodded at Ortega.
You can get me at Fell Street, same as the lieutenant here. Elias Riker, off-world liaison. I'm promising you this is going to go down, whatever happens. And when it does, I'll be a good person to know.
Ortega took the cue like she'd been doing it all her life, like Sarah would have done. She unleaned herself from the chair back and made for the door.
Be seeing you, Rutherford,
she said laconically, as we stepped back out onto the deck. The muscle was there, grinning widely and flexing his hands at his sides.
And you, don't even think about it.
I contented myself with the silent look that I had been told Riker used to such great effect, and followed my partner down the stairs. Back in the cruiser, Ortega snapped on a screen and watched identity data from the bug scroll down.
Where'd you put it?
Print over the fireplace, corner of the frame. She grunted.
They'll sweep it out of there in nothing flat, you know, and none of it's admissible as evidence anyway.
I know. You've told me that twice already. That's not the point. If Rutherford rattled, he'll jump first.
You think he rattled?
A little.
Yeah.
She glanced curiously at me.
So what the fuck is third-party retroassociative complicity?
No idea. I made it up.
Her eyebrow went up.
No shit?
Convinced you, huh?
Know what? You could have given me a polygraph test while I was spinning it, and I would have convinced that, too.
Basic onboard tricks. Of course, Rutherford will know that as soon as he looks it up, but it's already served its purpose.
Which is what?
Provide the arena. Tell lies, you keep your opponent off balance. It's like fighting on unfamiliar ground. Rutherford was rattled, but he smiled when I told him this stuff was why Cadman was acting up. I looked up through the windshield at the house above, formulating the scrapings of intuition into understanding. He was fucking relieved when I said that. I don't suppose normally he would have given that much away, but the bluff had him running scared, and him knowing better than me about something was that little ray of stability he needed. And that means he knows another reason why Cadman changed behavior. He knows the real reason. Ortega grunted approvingly.
Pretty good, Kovac. You should have been a cop. You notice his reaction when I told him the good news about what Cadman had done? He wasn't surprised at all.
No, he was expecting it, or something like it.
Yeah.
She paused.
This really what you used to do for a living?
Sometimes. Diplomatic missions or deep cover stuff. It wasn't...
I fell silent as she elbowed me in the ribs. On the screen, a series of coded sequences were unwinding like snakes of blue fire.
Here we go. Simultaneous calls. He must be doing this in virtual to save time. 1, 2, 3... That one's New York. Must be to update the senior partners. And, oops.
The screen flared and went abruptly dark. They found it, I said.
They did. The New York line probably has a sweeper attached. Flushes out the call vicinity on connection.
Or one of the others does.
Yeah.
Ortega punched up the screen's memory and stared at the call codes.
They're all three routed through discrete clearing. Take us a while to locate them. You want to eat?
Homesickness isn't something a veteran envoy should confess to. If the conditioning hasn't already ironed it out of you, the years of sleeving back and forth across the protectorate should have. Envoys are citizens of that elusive state here and now, a state that jealously admits of no dual nationalities. The past is relevant only as data. Homesickness was what I felt as we stepped past the kitchen area of the Flying Fish, and the aroma of sauces I had last tasted in Millsport hit me like a friendly tentacle. Teriyaki, frying tempura, and the undercut of miso. I stood wrapped in it for a moment, remembering that time. A ramen bar Sarah and I had skulked in while the heat from the Gemini Biosys gig died down. Eyes hooked to Newsnet broadcasts and a corner video phone with a smashed screen that was supposed to ring any time now. Steam on the windows and the company of taciturn Millsport skippers. And back beyond that, I remembered the moth-battered paper lanterns outside Watanabe's on a New Pest Friday night. My teenage skin slick with sweat from the jungle wind blowing out of the south, and my eyes glittering with tetrameth in one of the big windchime mirrors. Talk, cheaper than the big bowls of ramen, about big scores and Yazooka connections, tickets north and beyond. New sleeves and new worlds. Old Watanabe had sat out on the deck with us, listening to it all but never commenting, just smoking his pipes and glancing from time to time in the mirror at his own Caucasian features, always with mild surprise, it seemed to me. He never told us how he got that sleeve, just as he never denied or confirmed the rumors about his escapades with the Marine Corps, the Quell Memorial Brigade, the envoys, whatever. An older gang member once told us he'd seen Watanabe face down a room full of 7% angels with nothing but his pipe in his hands. And some kid from the swamp towns once came up with a fuzzy slice of newsreel footage he claimed was from the settlement wars. It was only 2D, hurriedly shot just before an assault team went over the top, but the sergeant being interviewed was subtitled Watanabe, Why, and there was something about the way he tilted his head when questioned that had us all crowing recognition at the screen. But then, Watanabe was a common enough name. And come to that, the guy who'd said he'd seen the angel's face down was also fond of telling us how he'd slept with a Harlan family heiress when she came slumming. And none of us believed that. Once, on a rare evening when I was both straight and alone at Watanabe's, I swallowed enough of my adolescent pride to ask the old man for his advice. I'd been reading UN Armed Forces promotional literature for weeks, and I needed someone to push me one way or the other. Watanabe just grinned at me around the stem of his pipe.
"I should advise you," he asked, "share with you the wisdom that brought me to this."
We both looked around the little bar and the fields beyond the deck.
"Well, yes."
"Well, no," he said firmly, and resumed his pipe.
"Kovach?"
I blinked and found Ortega in front of me, looking curiously into my eyes.
"Something I need to know about?"
I smiled faintly and glanced around the kitchen's shining steel counters.
"Not really."
"It's good food," she said, misinterpreting the look. "Well, let's get some, then." She led me out of the steam and onto one of the restaurant's gantries. The Flying Fish was, according to Ortega, a decommissioned aerial minesweeper that some oceanographic institute had bought up. The institute was now either defunct or had moved on, and the bayward-facing facility had been gutted. But someone had stripped the Flying Fish, re-rigged her as a restaurant, and cabled her 500 meters above the decaying facility buildings. periodically the whole vessel was reeled gently back down to earth to disgorge its sated customers and take on fresh. There was a queue around two sides of the docking hangar when we arrived, but Ortega jumped it with her badge, and when the airship came floating down through the open roof of the hangar, we were the first aboard. I settled cross-legged onto cushions at a table that was secured to the blimp's hull on a metal arm, and thus did not touch the gantry at all. The gantry was cordoned with the faint haze of a power screen that kept the temperature decent and the gusting wind to a pleasant breeze. Around me, the hexagonal grating floor allowed me an almost uninterrupted view past the edge of the cushions to the sea, a kilometer below. I shifted uneasily. Heights had never been my strong point.
"Used to use it for tracking whales and stuff," Ortega said, gesturing sideways at the hull. "Back before places like this could afford the satellite time. Of course, with Understanding Day, the whales were suddenly big money for anyone who could talk to them. You know they've told us almost as much about the Martians as 4 centuries of archaeologues on Mars itself? Christ, they remember them coming here. Race memory, that is."
She paused. "I was born on Understanding Day," she added inconsequentially.
"Really?" "Yep, January 9th. They named me Kristen after some whale scientist in Australia, worked on the original translation team."
"Nice." Who she was really talking to caught up with her. She shrugged, abruptly dismissive.
"When you're a kid, you don't see it that way. I wanted to be called Maria."
"You come here often?"
"Not often, but I figured anyone out of Harlan's world would like it."
"Good guess." A waiter arrived and carved the menu into the air between us with a holotorch. I glanced briefly down the list and selected one of the ramen bowls at random. Something vegetarian.
"Good choice," Ortega said. She nodded at the waiter. "I'll have the same. And juice. You want anything to drink?"
"Water." Our selections flared briefly in pink and the menu disappeared. The waiter pocketed the holotorch at his breast with a snappy gesture and withdrew. Ortega looked around her, seeking neutral conversation.
"So, you got places like this in Millsport?"
"On the ground, yes. We're not big on aerial stuff."
"No?"
She raised her customary eyebrow.
"Millsport's an archipelago, isn't it? You would have thought airships were..."
"An obvious solution to the real estate shortage? Right as far as that goes, but I think you're forgetting something." I flickered my eyes skywards.
"We are not alone."
It clicked.
"The orbitals? They're hostile?"
"Let's say capricious. They tend to shoot down anything airborne that masses more than a helicopter. And since no one's ever been able to get close enough to decommission one of them, or even get aboard, come to that, we have no way of knowing what their exact programming parameters are. So we just play it safe and don't go up in the air much."
"Must make IP traffic tough."
I nodded. "Well, yeah. Of course, there isn't much traffic, anyway. No other habitable planets in the system, and we're still too busy exploiting the world to bother about terraforming. Few exploration probes, and maintenance shuttles to the platforms. Bit of exotic element mining, that's about it. And there are a couple of launch windows down around the equator toward evening, and one crack-a-dawn slot up on the pole. It looks like a couple of orbitals must have crashed and burned way back when, left holes in the net." I paused. "Or maybe someone shot them down."
"Someone? You mean someone not the Martians?"
I spread my hands. "Why not? Everything we've ever found on Mars was raised or buried, or so well disguised we spent decades looking right at it before we even realized it was there. It's the same on most of the settled worlds. All the evidence points to some kind of conflict out there."
"But the archaeologues say it was a civil war, a colonial war."
"Yeah, right." I folded my arms and sat back. "The archaeologues say what the Protectorate tells them to say, and right now it's fashionable to deplore the tragedy of the Martian domain tearing itself apart and sinking via barbarism into extinction. Big warning for the inheritors. Don't rebel against your lawful rulers for the good of all civilization." Ortega looked nervously around her. Conversation at some of the nearer tables had skittered and jarred to a halt. I gave the spectators a wide smile.
"Do you mind if we talk about something else?"
Ortega asked uncomfortably.
Sure. Tell me about Riker.
The discomfort vanished into an icy stillness. Ortega put her hands flat on the table in front of her.